Welcome to this AHGB podcast, providing practical know-how to help your farm business. In this podcast, we focus on the importance of colostrum in newborn animals and discuss practical management advice to help you on your farm. Throughout the month of February, AHGB will continue the award-winning Colostrum is Gold campaign. This campaign allows farmers, vets, and other industry organisations to communicate the benefits of colostrum and its role in reducing the need for antibiotics in cattle, sheep, and pigs.
Hello, I'm Mandy Neville, and I'm the Head of Animal Health and Welfare here at AHGB. I'm a vet by training, but I'm delighted today to be trained by others with more expertise in the area. This is the time of year when many new animals are being born on farms, and we all know the importance that that first part of life has for the animal's future health and welfare. Colostrum, that first feed that the animal receives, is just so important. Receiving adequate colostrum quickly enough and in enough quantity can eliminate illnesses such as watery mouth in lambs, it can halve cases of pneumonia in calves, and generally it improves the survival rate in all newborn animals, including pigs, up to weaning age and far beyond that. And additionally, it also reduces the use of antibiotics in future life. But this time of year is always really busy, and the demands on producers and farmers is really intense, and we don't always have enough time to make sure that every single animal has enough colostrum or quickly enough. The Colostrum is Gold campaign, which is led by AHDB, collaborates with the industry to highlight the importance of colostrum to cows, sheep and pigs. That first milk produced by the mother following birth is full of antibodies, energy and other essential nutrients that can benefit the newborn animal. We're joined by speakers Emily Gascoigne and Tim Potter, who are both farm vets, and Pete Webster, who farms both beef and dairy cattle, as well as running a sheep enterprise in Cumbria. Emily, can you give us the latest advice for colostrum in lambs? For example, how much colostrum does a newborn lamb need, and in what sort of time frame?
So when we think about volumes of colostrum in lambs, the targets we're roughly aiming for are we want the lamb to have about 20% of its body weight in colostrum in day one, ideally half of that, so 10% to be given in the first 12 hours, and probably half of that again sort of in the first feed. So to put that in context, if the average commercial lamb's somewhere between sort of 3.5 to 4 kilos, we're going to be looking at about 800 mil in day one. I'd quite like the lamb to have had about half of that, so 400 mils within 6 hours, and a couple of hundred mils, so 200 mils within the first feed or shortly afterwards. We're hoping that mum, the ewe, is going to do the vast majority of that, but there may be certain scenarios where, as the farmer, we're responsible for providing that.
Emily, we know that some lambs still don't receive the recommended quantity of colostrum. So how can farmers ensure that they all receive that amount within the first couple of hours of life?
It very much depends on the system that we're operating, the conditions the ewes and lambs are faced with. In an outdoor situation, we're asking the mum, the ewe, to be almost entirely responsible for that, and ewe selection and looking after her, and in fact going all the way back to culling the year before is going to be really important to make sure she's got the tools and capability to deliver that. So a ewe with a nice high udder that's capable of milking on both sides. It is important to identify lambs who are by definition particularly high risk of not getting enough colostrum. Now, triplets and small lambs, we can probably identify them. Both indoor and outdoor lambing systems are going to be at high risk, either because of a sort of a lack of strength to get up and find colostrum, or because of competition when they actually get to the other udder. So they're individuals we can already identify are going to be potentially struggling to get colostrum. But there are other lambs in a lambing system, both indoors and outdoors. So those that have had difficult lambings, we know they are less likely to get sufficient colostrum. So identifying who they are and to potentially supplementing or supporting those ewes and lambs where necessary. think going right back to basics, making sure that there's enough colostrum there to start off with. Well, that preparation starts a long time before lambing, all the way probably back to culling and preparing for tupping the year before, making sure our ewes are in sufficient condition before they go to the tup and maintaining that as much as possible over winter, and then focusing on that feeding in the run-up to lambing. We know that for the ewe's health, the last 6 weeks pre-lambing are really quite important to make sure she's in good condition with enough energy and protein to prevent twin lamb disease for her own health and benefit. But all those same factors are really important in producing high quality and high volumes of colostrum. So the preparation really starts a long time before.
So how might a farmer know if that colostrum is not sufficient?
The early warning signs that we may be looking at a problem are potentially ewes approaching lambing that are in sort of suboptimal body condition score for their system, or if you've had pre-lambing bloods done about 3 to 4 weeks pre-lambing, that might give you a little bit of a clue that from an energy or protein perspective, our ewes are potentially at high risk of being an issue as we actually approach lambing.
So if we had a group of thin lambs at lambing, how would you approach those?
So if we are concerned in advance that there's going to be an issue with colostrum volume or quality, it may be that we need to prepare and either have an artificial source of colostrum ready to hand for those tricky situations, or if it's just a cohort of sheep within our broader flock, be prepared to pull colostrum from ewes that have surplus, for example, single bearing ewes, in order to share that with other lambs in the system. The practicality of all of those strategies may differ whether you're indoor or outdoor lambing, and it may be that you need to have a chat with your vet about which is most appropriate for you. In terms of our options of artificial supplementation, ewe's milk or colostrum from other ewes in good condition is always going to be preferable. It's going to have targeted immunoglobulins. We have got the option in sheep of looking to cow colostrum, but it's really important that you have a chat with your vet about making sure that that's appropriate for your system. There are potentially disease risks between cattle and sheep that we need to minimise. And we can look to powdered colostrums if we need to, but it's worth having a look at the quality and composition of those particular products in order to make sure you have got the highest quality. But use mum is always best where that's an option.
Thanks, Emily. Can you just give us some of your top tips for successful colostrum management?
As well as the volume of colostrum, which is really important, the speed with which these lambs are getting it is going to be crucial. Whilst we're, of course, really concerned from the perspective of immunoglobulins and the impact that has on immune status and immune health, actually, for quite a lot of these lambs, there's something that's going to kill them much quicker, which is getting cold and being hungry. So your clock is ticking for lots of these lambs. And as a general rule, 6 hours is the sort of stock clock that we have that's running concurrently with sort of the brown fat supply these lambs have in their inner engine. So having a system where you are keeping an eye out for that 6 hour clock, whether that's a marking system on the front of pens or how frequently you're doing your checks, that's really important to remember. Don't be afraid to freeze any surplus colostrum you have if you're pulling it from ewes. It'll keep for a long time in your freezer, and things like freezing bags, they're a really nice way of making sure you don't have to defrost a whole heap of it, and you can defrost ewe specific amounts. Whether you're using cow colostrum or ewe colostrum, how you heat it or defrost it is really quite important. You could be undoing all your good work of storing colostrum by essentially cooking the proteins that are in the colostrum. So careful defrosting, avoiding microwaves, and avoiding boiling the colostrum is really quite important. I think one of the things, or one of the groups of lambs that I think is often forgotten about, lambs that have had difficult lambings, they really are on a sticky wicket when it comes to getting up and getting sucked within that time limit and getting enough colostrum. So if you know there's an animal that, or a newborn lamb that you have had a difficult lambing with, even if mum is upright looking really happy, those are lambs that I would try to be really proactive with regards to supplementation, even if it's just the first feed, just to get them up well fed and safe.
I'm now joined by Tim Potter, who's a vet working largely in the cattle sector. Tim, what's the latest advice for colostrum in dairy calves?
So, Mandy, for dairy calves, I think ultimately the advice is the same for all the other species. It's getting good quality colostrum in as quickly as possible and getting the right volume of that. So for your average typical dairy calf, I think what we're really looking for is about 10% of the calf's birth weight within, at least within 4 hours and ideally within 2 hours after birth. So if we take an average birth weight of a dairy calf of around 35, 40 kilos, we're looking at about 4 litres ASAP after birth. And in terms of quality, what we're really looking for, if we start, what we're interested in is the immunoglobulins in that colostrum. And when you start measuring those, we want it to have a sort of greater than 50 milligrams per mil of sort of immunoglobulins.
Thanks. So that's quality, quantity, and quickly. And that's what I'm hearing across the sheep, the dairy. It's also true for pigs. So really across all the livestock species, it's quantity, quality, and quickly. Can you say, does that still apply to beef suckler calves too?
Yeah, absolutely. The same rule applies for the beef animals. They're ultimately the same, same physiologically. So actually their requirements are exactly the same. The challenges come in terms of their management and how that happens. I think within our dairy systems, we're frequently in a system where we've got an animal that maybe we're much more closely involved with the calving, the mother's being removed quickly and then she's being milked out. Whereas the sucklers, we have that different situation where the calf is being left with mum, and it may be slightly harder for us to measure what's going on with that calf and checking that the calf has had sufficient. It's worth bearing in mind, both for your dairy calf and your beef calf, if we're talking about them getting sufficient colostrum in that first initial 4 hours, it will take them about 20 minutes of constant suckling for them to get that kind of volume that we're talking about. So that 3.5 to 4 litres, you need to see them really go at the udder for about 20 minutes. And that's a sort of worth looking for and sort of making sure that they get that amount.
You talked about measuring the quality of colostrum, Tim. If a farmer is in any doubt about the quality of the colostrum, what should they do?
Absolutely, Mandy. So we've got various different tools available to us for measuring colostrum quality. There's colostrometers that literally just a sort of same kind of device that we'd use for measuring alcohol quantity. If we were making beer or wine at home, it literally just floats and gives us an idea of the density of the colostrum. Similarly, we can use refractometers, which will give us a reading of how much the sort of immunoglobulins are there. That gives us a way of assessing that colostrum, and it's much better than visually just looking at it. If we just look at it, it's very difficult to tell based on colour or appearance or even just the thickness of it, how good that colostrum is. So testing, it's great. And what it allows you to do is identify poorer quality colostrum. And in those circumstances, it's then thinking about how we can supplement it. So in the same way as Emily talked about for the sheep, it's going, OK, well, we can look to other sources. Ideally, yeah, we always want to use the mum's colostrum for her calf because it gives us the best immunoglobulins for that animal. But if the quality of the colostrum just isn't there, we may want to look at using colostrum from another animal in the herd. And we just need to be careful about disease control and making sure that we're not going to spread diseases around the herd. And the other alternative is we look at some of the sort of colostrum supplements and sort of freeze-dried replacers that are out there. But again, it's making sure that you are really clear about the quality of those bought-in replacer products, because actually we need to make sure that we're getting that those immunoglobulins. That's what we're really interested in.
Tim, if you could give us one piece of advice to your clients about colostrum, what would it be?
I see a lot of challenges with calf disease in all manner of systems. And whenever we have issues with that, often we look back and we go back and it can be traced back to issues with colostrum. So always prioritizing colostrum is going to be key. If you can get the animals off to that right start, it will make life a lot easier and a lot more successful for that calf as it goes through. So making sure you're prioritizing it. And as Emily alluded to, it's quite easy to think about which animals are going to be at higher risk of not getting sufficient colostrum. So I always encourage my clients to think about it going, right, if you're going in and assisting a calving, or you're getting a vet out to assist with a calving or doing a C-section, you're investing time and money to get that calf out, always then take the next step and make sure you get the colostrum into that calf, because that calf has had a stressful experience. It's less likely to get up and suck. And it's sort of taking that step, make sure it's always built into your sort of protocols, but focus on that.
Thanks, Tim. That's really interesting. Actually, I come from more of a piggy world where it's that attention to detail. When you think you've done the bulk of the work, it's the remainder that really does make the difference. So with sows that are farrowing, you know, making sure that if you're helping or you're just walking past that sow farrowing in the farrowing house, that you assist the pigs to get to that teat quickly, make sure things are clean, that the floor's not slippery, and that those pigs get that colostrum quickly with sufficient quantity. And, you know, the quality should be there if you've done your background work.
Absolutely, Mandy. And I think it's one of those things where we can look at having colostrum protocols, and people can view them as being time heavy and taking a lot of time to focus on that. But I think it's worth viewing the importance that that brings. And actually, if you have a disease outbreak of scours or pneumonia, think of the losses, think of the time that actually that incurs you. And so spending that extra couple of minutes making sure the calf gets the colostrum as soon as possible after birth can make your life so much easier long term.
Yeah, I was just going to add in that for all the three systems that we're talking about, whether it's the sheep context, beef or dairy, monitoring the process is a tool we can apply in all three of those systems. And I think we often forget that monitoring total protein in beef, suckler calves and also in lamb systems partway through lambing or calving or in the face of an issue is a very easy, cheap way of just recalibrating whether the standard operating procedures we've got in place are working, especially in a lot of sheep flocks where we're trying to reduce oral antibiotic usage, builds a bit of confidence that all the effort we've both described is actually helping.
So you've talked about alternatives to colostrum, so maybe collecting it from other cows or sheep, Emily. What are your top tips for making sure that colostrum is suitable? Are there tips on hygiene and cleanliness that you think are important?
So, yeah, hygiene is always going to be really important. These animals, and the reason we're giving them colostrum is because we want to provide them with immunity. The last thing we want to do is introduce the bugs that are kind of caused to disease. So on the dairy systems, I think the best way for anyone to think about this is view it in the same way that you would saleable milk. So think about what you do when collecting milk. Everything is cleaned as soon as possible after milking, and we're regularly monitoring the sort of the hygiene of the milking parlor. So do the exact same thing when you're collecting it. So any buckets that you're using, any clusters that you're using for collection from the cow need to be cleaned and regularly sterilized in the same way that you would with your normal kit. And it's the same way, prepare the udder. We don't want to dung, feces coming off the udder and getting into the calf. And then it also goes through to what you then use to administer the colostrum to the calf. Ideally, we get them suckling from a teat or a bottle. And again, we want to make sure that that's clean and regularly disinfected. If you do have to stomach tube, again, make sure it's clean. And I would always advise against people using the same stomach tube that they would use for administrating fluids to sick calves with diarrhea as they would for the one for giving colostrum. So having two sets on farm is ideal, so that you have one for your colostrum and then one for your sick calves. Then at least you've got time to sort of make sure everything's clean and possible that way. I don't know, Emily, do you have anything that you'd like to add from the sheep point of view on the sort of cleanliness?
Yeah, Tim, equally as important as in beef and dairy, and in the during the lambing window, some of this kit and equipment is getting quite a lot of use, whether it's in the quad bike or moving around a lambing shed, and given the population of animals we're talking about, highly vulnerable to E. coli infections, and we don't want our tubes to be mechanisms of mass destruction as they move around the shed. So cleanliness really important. In terms of an indoor lambing system, I often encourage my flocks to, when the equipment isn't being used, when it's got some downtime, chucking it in, washing it through, but leaving it to soak in baby sterilising equipment, and likewise in an outdoor lambing system overnight, leaving it to disinfect, just to sort of keep everything as clean as possible. And then just to remember sort of general hygiene around the shed where these lambs potentially are getting in contact with the infection even before they've had the colostrum, sort of keeping pens nice and dry, slightly at the mercy outside, but doing the best we can with sort of provision of shelter will just help the ewes as well.
We're joined today by Pete Webster, who's got both cattle and sheep on his farm. Hello, Pete. Can you give us an overview of your farm?
Hi, Mandy. Yeah, and thanks for welcoming me onto this podcast. So I run two farms. One of them is an upland beef and sheep farm. We have just shy of 800 ewes that are all outdoor lambed in mid-April. And we have 45 to 50 suckler cows that are calved generally inside from March onwards. And then as well as that, I have a tenancy on a farm in the Yorkshire Dales, and we have 140 dairy cows and 200 sheep on a lowland type system.
Thank you. We've heard from Tim and Emily about colostrum management, and it seems fairly straightforward. So quality, quantity, and quickly within those first 6 hours. But you're the farmer, you're the one on the ground. What are your priorities for managing colostrum, and how do you do it?
Yeah, so as Emily's already alluded to, really, we start the colostrum process way back at weaning time, really, and that's with the sheep flock, this is. So with the management of the ewes all the way through from weaning to pre-tupping, and then all the way through their pregnancy, making sure they have the correct condition score, the correct body weight, and managing them in appropriate size groups ultimately helps them all the way through to lambing and producing the best quality colostrum and milk thereafter. That we can, you know, that's the way in which we help those ewes through that system and that transition. And somewhat similar with the beef cows as well, and to some extent the dairy cows. The beef cows have generally a 4-month dry period where we make sure we wean the calf and we dry the cows off. And those cows are looked after very well all the way through to point of calving, ensuring they're the right body weight and body condition score. And again, manage them accordingly. If we think there are any issues, we'll put them to smaller groups. And exactly the same with the dairy cows. You know, we ensure they have a good dry off period. They have a minimum of 8 weeks. We select for any high cell count cows to tackle historic mastitis problems. We deal with that in the dry period. If anything's a little thin, then again we deal with that in the dry period, and we try and build body condition, which ultimately, you know, every stage of pre-birthing, I suppose, is a way to ensure we get better quality colostrum, and which means we're able to manage the colostrum once that calf or that lamb has been born.
So what are the major differences between the way you manage colostrum between your cattle and your sheep?
So there are a few major differences, I would say. Not many, but essentially with the dairy cows and the beef cattle, but certainly with the dairy cows, we do a lot of monitoring, so disease monitoring. So we're identifying cows that are potential Yoni's cows, potential BVD cows, and we're identifying them long before the point of calving. Because we definitely don't want to be feeding their colostrum, regardless of how good it is, we throw that away. And so I would say identifying the risks, identifying the disease points in those cows is a key to how we go about utilising that colostrum once the animal's given birth. And to some extent, that's the same with sheep. Again, we're blood testing for various diseases in sheep. And we identify them, and we wouldn't be taking colostrum off them to use across the rest of the flock.
When things go according to plan, Pete, it's quite straightforward, but we know that life's not like that. Have you ever encountered any problems? And if so, how have you overcome them with regards to colostrum?
Yeah, sure. I mean, farming isn't straightforward, and it certainly doesn't go according to plan most of the time. But, you know, times when we have come unstuck, not necessarily through poor management, but just through possibly not anticipating what was happening prior to it actually happening. So, I mean, simple things like the environmental challenges, whether that be, you know, poor weather at lambing time. If I think back to the beast from the east, you know, that really hammered us and hammered the sheep. And we definitely suffered with poorer colostrum on the back of that, even though sheep had been fed, you know, accordingly. The stress involved with the poor weather took its toll on the sheep and therefore on the lambs. So can you plan for that? To some extent, short term, you can by watching the forecast when you're lambing, try and, you know, take action. But that's a really difficult thing to manage. As well as that, I suppose we've possibly come unstuck a few years ago with we were challenged quite heavily by liver fluke in the sheep flock. And that happened over a series of months all the way through the autumn and carried into the winter. Just constantly drawing on the sheep. And it wasn't through lack of management and lack of treatment. It was just possibly the products weren't working correctly. But yeah, we felt that in a bad way at lambing time. You know, the sheep just didn't have good enough colostrum for that. And, you know, the same can be said when we've made slightly poorer silage crops than we would have liked with both the beef cows and the dairy herd. You know, if they're not consuming, if their nutrition, you know, isn't as good as it should be, that'll affect the colostrum quality. And we've definitely seen that in the past, and we've made steps to try and mitigate against that in the future.
Pete, can I ask, do you have a top tip or top tips for fellow farmers?
Yeah, so several top tips, I suppose, that we kind of rely on. I mean, yeah, where do we start? I suppose one thing is if you've got a team around you, if you've got staff members, make sure everybody's seeing from the same hymn sheet. You know, make sure everybody knows what to do, what the protocol is, what's the first thing we do, how we go about it. And that's everything from cleanliness that Tim's touched on, you know, making sure those cows' teats and also the sheep's teats are clean. That's, you know, that's a really good place for disease to transfer. So making sure that they're clean, making sure things are well bedded up so disease doesn't get a chance to stick to the udder. But that's making sure the whole team are on board. And then there's a whole host of different things. I mean, prepare well, you know, we've got a long time from tupping time to lambing time. It's a long time, you know, it's through some of our quieter periods when it comes to sheep farming. Same possibly with beef farming. You know, 8 weeks dry off period for dairy cows. We've got a long time to prepare for this, you know, one day when this animal is going to be born, or for this collection of weeks, you know, 3 or 4 weeks when we're going to be lambing or calving. So let's prepare well for that. Make sure everything works as it should. Make sure we've got enough artificial colostrum should we need it, enough teats, enough tubes, etc., etc. I mean, storage. So we collect a lot of colostrum, whether it be from the cows or the sheep, if there's something with excess. For sheep's colostrum, we're storing it in either ice cube trays or in yogurt pots. And with cows, again, more the dairy cows than the beef, but with the dairy cows, we have, I think they're 4-litre bags that we can reuse and that we can store in the freezer. So yeah, get a freezer on the farm and make sure you use it, you know, store that colostrum. A handy thing is to carry a thermos flask with you at lambing time. You know, we lamb outdoors. We're not a very high farm, but we're in the uplands. We get harsh weather. So by lambing outdoors, we're trailing around on the quad bike. If you have that thermos with some colostrum in it already, it's, you know, it's at the right temperature. Or if you see a sheep with excess, you can always capture some and store it there, you know, for a lamb that you might come to, you know, in the next field that needs it. So that's quite a handy thing to have.
That's a great tip. Thanks, Pete. We've known about colostrum and the importance of colostrum for years, for decades, mm-hmm. and yet we know that it's still one of the major causes of mortality in neonatal animals and mm-hmm. in those before weaning. When we look at calves that die, of lambs that die, a lot of them will be immunoglobulin deficient, which means that they have not had sufficient colostrum in the quantity, the quality, or within the time frame that they should have done.
Since our time being involved with Challenge Sheep, we've, you know, at the various different points of that project and throughout the year where we monitor both condition score and body weight. That's both of the dams and of the young. We're clearly able to identify how body condition score and body weight impacts ultimately on growth rate of the lamb and milkiness of that ewe, because we're getting birth weights, we're getting 8 week weights, we're getting 20 week weights, and you know, weaning weights if you're later than that. And you can follow it all the way through from probably tupping time. The poorer condition, the lighter ewes, the thinner ewes have the smaller lambs at birth weight, and those lambs never catch up. And in actual fact, those lambs are generally the ones that suffer. They might get watery mouth, navel ill, joint ill, you know, pneumonia, whatever it is. They might fall by the wayside to a clostridial. And I think all of those key data points will ultimately come back to the fact that that lamb didn't have enough and good enough colostrum at birth. Maybe it wasn't up and sucking quickly enough. Maybe it just wasn't big enough. Maybe there wasn't enough milk there in the first place. The other thing I would say is that I think we're very good in this country at making difficulties for ourselves and giving ourselves problems. And I think that, you know, there are so many tools out there to help us select the correct genetics or better genetics now that will help us, you know, sheep that have more natural vigor when they're born. So they get to their feet quicker, they're sucking quicker, you know, they're not lying on the ground for half an hour on a cold, frosty morning waiting to get to their feet. They're up and going within minutes. And the same, you know, with beef animals, selecting breeds that are easy calving, using your EBVs, you know, select easy birthing type bulls, so you've not got to cause stress to that calf when it's being born. You know, stress, I think, is a major factor in delaying that calf or lamb getting its to its feet and sucking quickly. So if we can, you know, if you're using all those different tools we have, that I think you know, definitely helps that newborn take its colostrum quicker, which will help it for the rest of its life.
I think the time frames of some of the things that we're talking about are bigger than or longer than I think the emphasis has previously been placed. In sheep, as an example, we spend a lot of time focusing on the last 6 weeks, but you know, we can see in all these species that actually the preparation for that happens an awful long time beforehand. And equally, I know we're talking about colostrum as gold, but ultimately what we're talking about is creating a really strong maternal lamb or calf relationship and setting up a female that's got real capability of lactate out to milk, because we need those for that successful colostrum relationship. Well, ultimately, whether you've got dairy cows in a parlour, a suckler cow and a calf, or a ewe and a lamb, all three of those systems rely on successful lactation. So I think actually exactly what Pete said, just this focus that actually our decisions are starting in the, particularly in the suckler scenario, the year before preparing for calf for the subsequent season. I think that's something we all continue. You know, I think the emphasis is moving certainly towards that.
We've heard that colostrum really is that liquid gold, and that first feed that a newborn animal gets, whether it's a lamb, a calf or a pig, well, it is the most important meal that that animal is going to get in its life. And good quality colostrum, the right quantity at the right time, will have long lasting effects on that animal's life and will protect it for weeks, if not months, to come. I'd just like to thank Tim, Emily and Pete for their input today. And if you'd like more information on Colostrum is Gold, please look at our website, and you can also follow our campaign on social media using the hashtag Colostrum is Gold. Thank you very much.